Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome. This is Project Zion podcast, and I'm your host today, Karen Peter. In our episode, we are visiting with Kent Thompson, who is with us via technology from Tucson, Arizona. And today we're talking with Kent about postmodernism and faith. So Kent and I met last year, I think, or maybe it was 2 years ago at Sunstone Symposium in Salt Lake City, where he had presented on postmodernism and the restoration traditions. And we had, I invaded a conversation that Kent was having with somebody else, but it was so fascinating, and it took a while for us to get him on the podcast because he's a parent, a teacher, and a doctoral candidate at the University of Arizona in Tucson. So he's a busy guy. So Kent, first, welcome to Project Zion.
Thank you so much. Really, really glad to be here.
So as we begin our conversation about postmodernism and faith, can you tell us a little bit on why this topic is of interest to you?
Absolutely. So just quick background. I am a history teacher by trade. I was that for 6 years, and then I transitioned to the dark side and actually went into administration and became a principal, high school principal, and was doing that until 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago now, when I had transitioned to become a full-time doctoral student. And my goal eventually is to become an educational professor at a college somewhere. And for me, being a history teacher, that everything that I've done, everything that I want to do has a root in history. And concepts and ideas, themes in history are something that have always been important to me. And myself, former Mormon, transitioned away from that tradition about 5 years ago now. And that led me down a lot of paths of learning that opened up ideas and concepts and things that I had never fully explored before. My dissertation research is on people who are brand new to principling and how their identities are changed through the process of becoming socialized into the position. And in doing so, I've become steeped in literature on sociological identity theory, and that was very easy to transition into concepts and ideas about religious identity. And so Sunstone, for last year, they had put out a call for papers to present. And so I said, hey, you know, I really want to study more about this outside of what I had been doing for my own dissertation research, a little bit to the chagrin of my advisor who wants me focused on my dissertation research. But so I did a deep dive into religious identity. And in doing so, came across the concepts and ideas of modernism and postmodernism and their effects on especially United States religious traditions. And of course, with my background in Mormonism, then I dove pretty deeply into concepts and ideas surrounding religionist or restorationist traditions. So that that really led me then to my presentation and where we are today to be able to talk about this.
So we need a little refresher for some of our listeners, and probably for me. So to understand postmodernism, it helps to first have a basic understanding of modernism, and you've used both of those terms. So can you define for us modernism in some short, brief way?
I will do my best.
Okay.
I always preface any deep conversation by starting with a college professor of mine, a history college professor, who said he could not answer any question without saying, well, in 1215, when the Magna Carta was signed, and then he would go, you know, take it from there. I won't do that. It'd be that
bad. Thank you.
But the history teacher in me does come out a little bit. And so with modernism is a term used to express the ideas that were before that it influenced and were during the Enlightenment period of time. This is importantly to the idea of modernism is to a shift from dogmatic faith-based realities, and I'll use some fancy words here in a moment to explain what they mean, into a new scientific reason, logic-based reality, ways of knowing, ways of being. There's two words that I'll be using some probably throughout the interview, and those are ontology and epistemology. They're fancy words, and there's lots of nuance there, but ontology basically is questions of our existence, our reality. Why are we here? What's the purpose of life? Those are ontological questions. Epistemology is how do we know things? How do we go about gaining knowledge? That's epistemology. And so the shift, the ontological and epistemological shift from faith and dogma into reason and logic had seismic effects on humanity, on social structure, on all kinds of things. And so modernism really represented a throwing off of thousands of years of ideas and things that that set the standard for society and blew it up. Specifically to modernism, one of the things that's interesting is before the Enlightenment, before that era, knowledge, the ability, the power of knowledge was really hidden behind two spheres, and one of them was the church. In Western traditions, mostly then in the Roman Catholic Church, and it was hidden behind the Latin language. And so if you wanted to know anything about what God willed for you, you had to go to a priest who then could consult this book. And this book was written in Latin, and then they could interpret it for you and tell you what was going on. The rituals and things like that were just the mystery, right? And so knowledge about being able to how we exist with God and our existence with each other was all determined by the church. The other half of that then is the power that is hidden or that was hidden away from the regular people, from the governments, generally monarchies and things like that. And the Enlightenment, there's various ways that that affected government. Specific to Western democracies, the two big ones then are England, Great Britain, and France. And England, Great Britain was more of a gradual change. And then in France, it was the French Revolution, very bloody, which threw off absolute monarchy. Whereas Great Britain, England tried a little bit more of a gradual to where we are now in the effects of those. So modernism really then, again, just to recap, is a shift, a massive shift, societal shift, from dogma and faith being the reason for everything, why are we here, the way that we can know everything, shifts into this idea of logic and reason. We can talk more about the logic and reason here in a moment, but I think that's just super important to understand is that shift that occurred during the Enlightenment.
So for people that have studied maybe a little bit about this in the past and picked up pieces of this, this would then be the period of time where the church was not willing to accept the Enlightenment, right? And they pushed back hard against science and reason.
Yeah, and there's lots, and there's, so history isn't linear. It's easy for us to think that it is. It's easy for us to fall into those like ways of looking at history as a linear project. It really isn't. So you have early examples and late examples of things that shouldn't really be there. You have contradictions all over the place. One of my favorites is Sir Isaac Newton, incredible mathematician, just an amazing Enlightenment man. But he was also incredibly devoutly Christian. And he spent an enormous amount of time studying the Bible and the earliest manuscripts that he could get his hands on to find out the mathematical computations that went into Solomon's temple, because he believed that those measurements, if he could extract the formula and then figure it out, that he could actually predict the end of the world. So here's an Enlightenment man who's all about reason and scientific method, who is also at the same time deeply steeped in a very archaic system of trying to predict the end of the world using modern tools with, anyway, it's an interesting.
Yeah. Great example. Thank you.
Yeah.
So we have this kind of short history. We won't start with the Magna Carta, so thank you. We have a short history of the rise of modernism and why it's important. And so through this period, you talked about these spheres that knowledge was hidden behind, and they start breaking down these barriers. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So then as those barriers dissolved, how did modernism affect religion then, or transform religion? I think the term you use is a rational faith. So what happened?
Correct. Yeah. So we, So we have a shift as barriers are broken down, as, for example, as the Bible is able to be translated. One of the very first translations out of Latin was known as the Vulgate. And that word, the root vul, is vulgar. It's actually, English was considered a vulgar language. And so to have the Vulgate and then the Bibles that came after it was massive. It was huge. And so that had the great, very quick effect of people suddenly saying, well, I can read my own Bible now and I can interpret my Bible. And I think that that priest that's been telling me this stuff for years is wrong. And in fact, here's my interpretation. And I feel called of God to go forth and do this. So there's an explosion of anti-Catholic, anti-establishment religion groups who come up. And beyond the scope of what we are talking about today, there's so many different groups that do this. You know, you have Luther, who, you know, he doesn't find any of those things that the Catholic Church is espousing, especially with various indulgences and things like that in the Bible. And he has his 95 theses, and famously, or whether it actually happened or not, but nailed the 95 theses to the door and things like that, gets excommunicated. There's many aspects of this that come out of it. So at the very basic level, we have this concept and idea where people then can become religious themselves. They don't need the institution. And so this decoupling starts to occur where a person doesn't have to have a religion to do that. But because they're so socialized into having a religion, they tend to still have religion. They just create their own, and they claim some authority, or they claim some ideas that then give them the basis by which to practice those new beliefs. And they become the subject of significant amounts of strife politically. It leads to issues of people, you know, coming to the United States eventually with the Pilgrims, which are themselves a sect, an offshoot of different things, which creates all kinds of problems. And anyway, that's, again, beyond the scope here. But there are, at the basic level, we have this idea of people now can interpret for themselves and they can set their own paths. And that is huge. And they create these new religions that then do that in the beginning of the modern era. As the modern era continues, it starts to shift. And we'll talk about that more when we get to postmodernism.
Okay, it does begin to shift. And religion, as we understand it from the, I'm in my early 60s. So when I was a kid, that would be like the epitome of modernism in religion from the 1950s, that image that we have of that, that era and such. So how did we get there to where that became the norm?
Absolutely. So I think it's important to talk about, there are three tenets of modernism that we can see exemplified in religious traditions. One of the tenets of modernism is that there is an absolute truth. If you think about it scientifically, this is the idea of, like, the law of gravity is the law of gravity. Gravity occurs. It happens. It is an absolute. We think of it when we think of it in terms of God and religion, this is this idea then of, there is an absolute truth. There is a God, he has rules and laws, and this is how it is. And that pretty much exemplifies most modern religions, like you said, in the era that you were talking about there. The second tenet of modernism is that truth can be discovered through experiments and reason. And I'd like to talk about this a little bit more when we get to the restorationist traditions, mm-hmm. because it's specific to early Mormonism. But there is a huge rift in the Mormon brethren in the early 20th century between Joseph F. Smith and James Talmadge. The former is the faith-based person, dogma-based person, and the latter is the reason and logic. And although Joseph F. Smith wins and Talmadge is censored, Talmadge's influence is huge throughout the rest of the middle 20th century, and late 20th century as well. The third tenet of modernism is that absolute truth can be then dispatched to dispel all untruths. It's this idea of wielding truth as against untruths. And again, we'll talk about it a little bit more in the religious context a little bit later.
Okay. So one of the ideas that you talk about in your presentation, your Sunstone presentation, was the failure of modernism ultimately and the rise of postmodernism. So in contrast to modernism, what is postmodernism? We again need that brief kind of primer, if you will, on postmodern thought. So go for it.
Absolutely. So again, it's important to note that history is not linear. So it's not like in 1970, modernism ended and postmodernism began, right? So there are philosophers, Nietzsche is one of them, who very much has postmodern ideas, but he's not considered a postmodernist. So I just want to be very clear that this is a very complicated, difficult subject, and I am making broad generalizations here. But by and large, postmodernism is a reaction to the what they consider the failures of modernism. And there's a quote, go ahead and read it here. I think that's very poignant. I'll read it here in a moment. But the lived realities of modern societies, with its cold application of reason towards irrationalism, it proved problematic as it birthed really the horrors of the world wars in the 20th century. Obviously, incredibly terrible wars, and these were all done under the pretense of logic and reason, very calculated things, Nazi death camps, things like that, to rid people that were considered not good for the species and things like that. I mean, terrible application of these modernist ideals. And so the quote here, and I'll give you a list of all of my references here, but this is by a person named Pippin, back in 1999, wrote, "The fact that art, intellectual pursuits, the development of the natural sciences flourished in close spatial temporal proximity to massacre and death camps has raised for many doubts about not only modernity's self-assurances, but about of all of Western culture. And it has raised the issue, why did humanistic traditions and models of conduct prove so fragile a barrier against political bestiality?" I think it's really well said. It's the idea of how could something that proposed to end problems with religions and things like that, create an atmosphere that would allow for all of these things. So postmodernism then is a real reaction to that.
So one of the ways I've heard modernism described is that it was this idea that the more we learn and we can continue to learn, the better we can make things. And so modernism was the idea we'll get better and better and better and better until we've eradicated all the problems in the world. And so the world wars, as you have said here, that just blew that sky high.
Correct. Yeah. Because then it became, oh, suddenly somebody had an idea about what the final modern project needed to look like, a la Hitler. And obviously that didn't jive very well with everybody else in the world. And it created a major problem. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So postmodernism then, there's a couple of quotes here that I'll read. Postmodernism itself attacks the very core of the modern project. It questions the existence of any truth, universal or otherwise, and the ability of human reason to find it. So again, postmodernism rejects any claim of absolute truth. It is an attempt to impose one worldview over others. And further still, the truth is not out there waiting to be discovered. What human beings take to be truth is something that we ourselves have constructed. So postmodernism, one of the big things about it is this idea of constructs, this idea of our truths being relative to our epistemologies and on our ontologies. There isn't one absolute truth, that there are many truths. And most importantly, the healthy aspect of postmodernism is this concept and idea that you can't impose one worldview over another. And although there are problems with postmodernism and critiques of it, I think this is one of the more the aspects of it that push back against the cold modernity of the world wars, and definitely opens up more space for more people.
So this is really interesting to me, and one of the things that is coming to mind when you describe that is both a visual and a contextual comment. And the editors might want to move this and put it somewhere else after we start talking about restoration traditions. But during the 1950s and early 1960s, the RLDS Church was extremely modern And it was, we are the one and only, we are right, we have all the answers, you know, we're fighting communism like everybody else, and we had the truth. And then we went into East India and encountered polygamous tribal people. And polygamy is a big sore spot with Community of Christ. Yeah, we were the, it never happened, Joseph never did it people for many, many years, until history and scholarship forced us to look more carefully at what we had been professing, and to admit that perhaps we were incorrect, which is very hard for people who have been right. As we encountered polygamous tribes who wanted to join the RLDS Church, there became a question, what do we do about polygamy? And in that moment, I think, is the moment the RLDS Church moved from a modern perspective to a postmodern perspective. Because rather than saying they can't join unless they give up all of their extra wives, the church said they can all join, but they can't add any new, can't be from here on any additional. That is what I hear you describing. Instead of putting the truth, the view of what the truth was for the church at that time, onto another culture, they found a way to navigate that for the best of everybody involved. And it was our first foray into globalism as a church.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really well said. What ends up happening with the postmodern turn is you have both a liberalization that occurs, of which you described there with the church. And then you have the other one, which is a fundamentalism that occurs, which occurs within the Mormon church, into what I term the Mormon institutional conservatism. And so there's a reaction to this. In fact, right now, if you want to, we can talk about the four areas in which there is a postmodern turn and has affected American churches.
Sure, let's go there.
Does that work? Okay. One thing I think that's important to talk about the specifics to American religions is America itself is very different from the rest of the world in a lot of ways. And one of them is there's a embedded individualism into American psyche and society that actually has an interesting effect on religious traditions. There's always been a real tending towards this idea of it's the individual experience, it's not just a collective experience. So for example, in the early 19th century, you have the itinerant Methodist preachers that are going around, and they don't have to have necessarily a degree from somewhere. They just say, I feel that God has spoken to me, and I need to talk about this. And I'm not trying to start a religion. I just need to preach. I need to preach. And it's a lot of what they were preaching was this idea of individualism and your relationship with God, and you don't necessarily need a church and things like that. So that has already kind of been baked into the system. And when we get to this list. So the liberal developments then on the postmodern movement, there are four areas in which this one particular author, Dinges, talks about. And that is the four are the loss of institutional salience, the cultural uncoupling of spirituality from religion, the loss of institutional control of religious symbols, and then the rise of transdenominationalism. So these are really the four areas, and you described some of them within your story there, the Community of Christ. So one of the things about the loss of institutional salience is this particular author refers to the individuals as lay liberals. These are individuals who they belong to a specific church, but they aren't necessarily the traditional all-in member. They are, I like the priest, I like to go, I like the religious aspects of things, I like the ceremony, I like those things, but I don't like what they teach about this or that. And they feel like they can go to that church and do those types of things. So religions that allow that, then those individuals will stay in, but religions that don't allow that, those individuals then have to find a new home. And so we do see pretty significant shifts in people away from the more conservative, small c conservative religions into the more small l liberal religions. And there's different examples of this throughout the last half of the 20th century and early part of the 21st century, specifically with the different Protestant groups that start to allow women into the priesthood, such as the Community of Christ, and things like that, that start to make a shift mm-hmm. towards those things. So that is, again, the loss of institutional salience. And then we have the cultural uncoupling of spirituality from religion. And this is super important. This is this idea that, again, it's very individualistic. This idea of I can be spiritual, but I don't have to go to church. Small C conservative religions mock those ideas and say, well, you have to have the church because we have the rites and the traditions and things like that. The more liberal side of things says, yeah, you need to develop this aspect of yourself. And this is becomes a really important part of your relationship with a deity or your relationship with the universe or whatever it may be. And this uncoupling then further erodes the American institution of religion because people no longer really need an institution to tell them what to do. And they start to do those things. Three, again, is the loss of control over religious symbols. A good example of this is the cross. The cross has very specific symbolic reasoning and ideals in it within certain religions. And then you have the generic idea of the cross for a lot of Christians, which is simply to remember Jesus or just to remind yourself of a higher power and things like that. So mm-hmm. You're not in control of that symbol anymore.
So I have a neighbor who wears a cross. I have a neighbor that wears a cross, but he doesn't have any interest in going to any church.
Absolutely.
So is that what, that's the kind of thing? Yeah. Okay.
Perfect example. Yeah. I've walked into homes of people who have very ornate crosses in their home and they're not religious at all. They just love the iconography. They think it's real beautiful. They love it for the aesthetic of it rather than the religious meaning behind it. Then finally is transdenominationalism. And you had actually asked what's the difference between polydenominationalism, and the difference really is in the root word trans, meaning to transcend. So transdenominationalism means that, for example, people will attend a mega church, and a lot of mega churches, some mega churches are affiliated with a specific religion, but growing now are non-affiliated mega churches. They have a general heading of Christianity, but even that, what does that even mean? They don't really actually tackle it at all. It's just simply, let's get together and talk about good things in their opinion. That then creates a subset of individuals who then can bounce from mega church in person to mega church online to wherever, and they just simply feel this community around them of other like-minded people. So it again removes brick and mortar institutional religion that we've had for thousands of years into more of an esoteric way of worshiping, so to speak, and becoming a part of that spiritual community.
Okay. So listening to these things, of course, my mind is interpreting them all from a lifetime in Community of Christ, starting in Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which became Community of Christ. So before we kind of go there, because I know that you have some comments to make about some comparisons, let's talk a little bit about just across the board, Christian denominations, how they've kind of reacted to the postmodern reality, these four issues, and see where we go from there before we kind of launch into restoration traditions.
Absolutely. So, and I think an important thing to talk about or to state is the liberalization of American churches has led to a significant decrease in the amount of people who belong to specific religions, especially within the liberal wing of religion. Interestingly, then, what has happened is the more fundamentalist religions actually have more people coming to them. Maybe a better way of saying it is they're losing less people than the more liberal wings, which I think is really interesting. So the liberalization of churches is almost going too well for those particular groups, as they are saying, believe what you want to believe. We want you here. We want you part of our community. And then that tends to open up ideas of like, well, why do I even need to come to a church anyway? And so more people are leaving those religions. The fundamentalist religions are seeing a resurgence. And in fact, back on the postmodernism thing real quick, again, one of the tenets of postmodernism is this idea of there are many truths. And so many religionists now are using postmodern arguments, not all postmodernism, but using postmodern arguments to say, hey, we have the truth because our truth is the truth, because we can have a truth because there's a lot of truths. But they don't talk a lot about the other truths, and we'll talk about that and specifically with the Mormon tradition. But it's an interesting argument, and they really push back against this idea of we can't have an absolute truth because everybody can have a truth. But we know the truth. So it's this mixture of modernism and postmodernist argument. It's kind of interesting. So, and again, I think one of the more fundamental religions that we're not going to talk about here, but I just pointed out because it's all over the literature that I read here, is actually the effect of Islam. Islam is a very fundamentalist religion, and they have yet to experience and have the idea of the Enlightenment like Western religious traditions have had. And so it'd be interesting to see how that progresses in the history of humanity here. Mm-hmm. So just as an aside.
Christian denominations, how they've reacted.
So basically it's one of two things. Either they have decided to, as a community of Christ, which is embrace this idea of postmodernism, embrace the ideas of opening up community, or they have retrenched. So if you want to now, I think it's a good time to talk about the restorationist
Absolutely.
Traditions. So one of the things in my research and everything, I only found one restorationist tradition who went on the liberal side, and that is the Community of Christ. Every other offshoot from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints established in 1830 they are either defunct or they have gone conservative. And that's been a really interesting thing. Specifically with what I will refer to as mainline Mormonism, and I know Mormonism isn't the proper term anymore, but it's much easier to say than modern Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So
that's true.
Modern.
That's
true. So just for brevity, I'll utilize that. What I have seen is what I termed the Mormon institutional conservatism. And this is this idea of the institution itself has a small C conservative direction, bent, ontology, epistemology, everything that creates this opportunity for it to resist the effects of this. And we see this throughout all kinds of rhetoric. I think there's one quote that I pulled from in my presentation, but there are a lot of different ones. And so this one is from Dallin Oaks, who is a member of the Quorum of 12 Apostles in the Mainline Mormon Church back in 2010 in a talk that ended up in a youth manual. Here's the quote. He says, "I will speak about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as the only true and living church. In doing so, I know I speak against the powerful tide of what is called political correctness. The fashionable opinion of this age is that all churches are true. In truth, the idea that all churches are the same is the doctrine of the Antichrist, illustrated by the Book of Mormon account of Korihor. That account was given to teach us a vital lesson in our day." So I picked this quote because it, I think, perfectly illustrates the reaction of conservative churches to the postmodern movement. And that is one of fear. There is a lot of fear in this statement, fear of change from the individual and instilling of fear in an individual of change. Political correctness is a term that is used quite a bit by conservative churches to push back against the idea of more than one way to be a human being, whether it's religiously or whatever. By equating this idea of there is truth in every church, all churches can be true, to then suddenly flip it and say that is a doctrine of the Antichrist, right? Is this instilling of fear in people of like, oh my gosh, if I think about this, I am like Korihor. Korihor is in the Book of Mormon is a character who is very much an Enlightenment man. Obviously, several, it's like 1700 years before the Enlightenment, he's a person who's a rational thinker, a logistician, and basically says, I don't believe that there is a God. I can't prove that there is a God. You can't prove to me that there is a God. I need a sign. And so he goes in front of the chief judge, and there's this big thing. And basically, he asks for a sign, and then God gives him a sign by striking him dumb, right? He can't speak. And this happens. And then he is forced to recant. And then he, you know, I'm so sorry, you know, kind of a thing like that. But he tries to make penance. But in the end, he is trampled to death trying to find food. And thus, okay. Korihor, right? So, so to mainline Mormon audiences, this this particular story is incredibly poignant, as Korihor is one of those evil men in the Book of Mormon who not only does he tempt God, but he is absolutely, his end is terrible. So yeah. It's not like he was able to go off and join his own community and create this wonderful existence and then live out his life. So yeah, so that's Korihor. So the Mormon institutional conservatism is rooted in this focused voice of authority of correlated doctrines and messaging that really came out of the various correlation committees that were under the direction of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles in the mainline Mormon church since 1972. There was a huge shift. Before 1972, it was doctrinally, it was kind of the Wild West. You had all kinds of different authorities making all kinds of different statements about things, very modernist as far as a lot of logic into why, for example, blacks couldn't have the priesthood. You had some pretty atrocious things said about the curse of Cain, and that that blacks in the pre-existence were not as good, so that's why they have this curse on them, and all these horrible things that before 1972 were just floating out there, said by some pretty high up authorities. After 1972, you really don't see a lot of those things. Well, you see it still, but it's a huge clamping down. It's this, again, institutional conservatism. It's we're trying to bring it back down to where, for example, when I was first married, this was in the early 2000s. The gospel doctrine classes that I attended are very different from my last gospel doctrine class that I taught in 2016. In just 16 years, I saw a big difference between, you still had the old guard who would sit there and espouse these weird theories from early Mormon leaders, to where we had been correlated to the point where it was a very tight, non-controversial, as much as possible message that we just simply repeated things rather than speculated about things. So there's among mainline Mormons, there's a real shift, and I'm 41, people about my age probably, if they look back, can see that happen in their own home wards and different things like that. And again, as you pointed out, when the Community of Christ started making their own changes towards the liberalization side, you see the same effects. In my research, and obviously you're the expert here, so you can.
No, I'm not the expert. I just have little stories.
sounds good. So, but the shifts and the changes that you have, some of the old guard in the old reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who aren't ready to accept more people and aren't ready to have women have the priesthood and aren't ready for this. And there's a schism and there's problems there. So in each restorationist tradition, there is a tremendous upheaval that occurs as a result of postmodernism. One is you have people like me who end up leaving the mainline Mormon church because it's not liberalizing. It's not taking into account LGBTQ issues. It's not taking into account these things. In fact, it's doubling down and making, in my opinion, some pretty harmful statements. And then you got the same thing, but opposite in the Community of Christ, where things are a lot more open and things are changing in that way. But then it's also leaving behind a subset of people who want that small C conservative religious tradition experience mm-hmm. in restorationist traditions. So I think there's a good juxtaposition between the two.
So when I look at your comments about Community of Christ, you've said that you found it to be the only real example of any kind of progressive movement from the various restorationist traditions that you looked at. So what did you find?
With regard to Community of Christ?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Community of Christ, again, I mean, I've talked about a few of them briefly, but the idea of women being able to have the priesthood, that is a huge liberalization movement within the restorationist tradition. The patriarchy, the power of the priesthood and the keys was so ingrained with men that to open it up to women as well, for me as a mainline Mormon at the time, I remember, you know, I always had proclivities towards like, yeah, why can't we do this? But then it was like, but God has said that we can't do this. You know? So to me, the women in the priesthood is huge. I think I think Community of Christ is incredibly well embodied in John Hamer, with who he is as an individual, and just a beautiful man, wonderful man, being able to be the leader of a congregation and be gay, and to be able to talk about things however he wants to. I just think it's such a refreshing thing, again, from being within the mainline Mormon religion. There isn't an outlet for members of the church to speak openly about things without fear, real fear of being removed from the church, excommunicated, or I don't know what the new terminology is they just released, but it's basically excommunication. So being able to speak and be who you are without fear of losing your community is, that's huge. That's absolutely huge. And again, within the restorationist tradition, then you can cling on to, like, you yourself are not a Book of Mormon person, but I know people who are members of the Community of Christ who are still very rooted in Book of Mormon ideals, and that's a big part of who they are. But again, it's a pick and choose. They don't have to say, well, I love that part where it talks about how the skin got darker when they sinned. Like, that, they can say, it's not a historical document, but there are some things in there that are powerful for us to learn from. And again, that as restorationist tradition, that's huge. And that allows—
Actually, we took that part out, Kent, just FYI.
Yeah, that part was removed. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
Because we don't just go, oh, we don't talk about it. We like, oh, let's excise that.
Right.
Yeah.
We're like, if it is what we believe it is, then we just, we can move it on out. So.
Yeah. So there are some things that I recognize in the Community of Christ tradition that are reacting to the reality of postmodern thought in religion. For example, the church has recognized and is reacting to the lessening of social significance. I think you called it the loss of institutional salience. But
right,
that's what it is. I mean, the institution itself, it's like, wait a minute, in society today, even in religious society, what is the role of institution? And so we've been processing that and pondering that and making that part of our community conversation. But also the focus on individual spirituality and corporate spirituality is that, at this juncture of our existence, completely separate from religion? Or is there a way to bridge religious traditions of sacrament and, you know, rites and practices and ideas? Is there a way to bridge that effectively? And if so, what symbols and rites and practices have to be reinterpreted? So, for example, we're all online right now because we are talking in the midst of the pandemic of 2020. And in our reality in Community of Christ, before the pandemic, the First Presidency made provision for us to have the Sacrament of Communion online. And that was a huge step for us. But after the pandemic, the First Presidency came out with a policy change so that we could also offer the prayer for the sick, the laying on of hands for the sick online. So we are reinterpreting what those symbols and practices mean in community when you're not together there. And how do we continue to do that? And the final one that I see is that in the midst of all of this, as we encounter more and more people who are reacting to the fundamentalism from their own traditions and coming to Community of Christ, how we understand membership comes into question. Because is membership an official something that happens, or is membership when I align myself with a group of people, even if I have not followed the institutional process of joining something? So what are your thoughts in light of that?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So in each of those examples you gave, I could see the thread of the postmodern, right? This idea of, okay, we have this tradition, we have this policy, we have these things. How can we open it up more? How can we make it more accessible, right? Those, again, are rooted in the idea of the liberalization movement, this idea of how can we give more? How can we be a part of this more? And again, me as a former mainline Mormon and still very clued into the Mormon ethos. All my children are still Mormon. My ex-wife is Mormon. And my whole family's Mormon, things like that. They just had their general conference last weekend. So I'm still very steeped in what's going on. There still tends to be the opposite of what you're describing, which is how can we make sure we protect the institution? How can we protect these rights? How can we do these things? For example, the sacrament being given in homes along the policy currently in the church is that you cannot do that on your own unless you have permission of your bishop. And that is under extraordinary circumstances. And it's up to each bishop to determine whether this is okay or not. And being on Facebook, I know that the particular ward that my where I'm currently living right now, the bishop has given permission for people to do that, to do those things, which I think is appropriate and great, so that they can do it in their own homes and they don't have to congregate. But I've read online from other people that are like, yeah, no, this is not what's going on in my home ward. We cannot do this. Like the bishop has said, no, like you don't have permission to do this. And again, I ask, well, why is that? And so again, to me, it just goes back to the idea of, well, there's a lot of confusion and definitely with the pandemic going on, but there is a tendency towards how can we protect the tradition, protect the institution over creating things that really work more for more people. And what you're describing is the opposite of that. So I think it's a really good juxtaposition then again of the two ways of doing restorationist traditions.
So just to throw more complexity into the midst of the discussion, some sociologists would say that we're moving past postmodernism and into yet another social construct or perspective, which is postmodernism. What does that look like, and how do you see that impacting religious traditions as we experience that new reality?
That's a great question. So one of the problems with any kind of construct, modernism is a construct, postmodernism is a construct, postmodernism is a construct, is when we are living through a specific construct that is being made while we are flying in it, it's hard to really be able to take a 30,000 foot view and really say, well, this is what the tenets are of it. Postmodernism is easier in 2020 to talk about because it started in the 1970s as a real intellectual way of thinking. Post-post is still relatively new, but basically it's this idea of, okay, we need to critique postmodernism, and all modernism isn't inherently bad. So what can we bring in from modernism and postmodernism to create a new reality and a new construct? So it definitely takes the idea of the constructs, but it also looks back at modernity and says, you know, although where postmodernism can really lead you down the path of there are no truths ever at all, modernism, if you bring a little bit of that in, it's like, well, maybe there is something going on that we can tap into, where we can create a lot of it is a philosophical issue. So it's an idea around morals and ethics, and this idea of, mm-hmm. well, if everything's right, then how can anything be wrong? And if nothing is wrong, how can we create laws and things like that that then punish people for doing things? It obviously is very messy, like you prefaced this question with.
Yeah.
So post-post really is about how do we take the messiness of postmodernism and make it a little bit less messy to be able to move society forward in a way that it recognizes the rationality issues as well of modernism being something that is good. And so, yeah, it's just trying to figure out how we move forward with that.
So I had a conversation with someone who had left the LDS tradition and was exploring a little bit what the community of Christ might mean if this person became kind of a friend of and was willing to travel a little bit with community of Christ. They weren't sure yet, but the way they described where they were to me is kind of this postmodernism. They said they left the LDS tradition and they threw the baby out with the bathwater. And now they were recognizing that they still wanted to play with the baby. And I found that to be a really interesting example as I began to hear about postmodernism, because it kind of feels like that's what happened.
That's a great way to put it. And I think that's just an excellent, succinct way to talk about it. It's this idea of, all right, postmodernism really does throw modernism completely out as much as possible. And now it's like, okay, well, maybe there were some good things about it. But it's like, again, it's like anything else, whether it's our own individual journeys or it's a societal journey, we're all on a journey. Things are happening. Things are constantly bombarding us and changing us. And although we didn't get into the identity theory piece that I'm doing for my dissertation, a lot of it really does come around this idea of, all right, well, what is important to all of the institutions that we belong to, right? So just because we're not maybe belong to a specific religion, we still belong to a family, and we still belong to a country, and we still belong to a political party, maybe, or we belong to a club. I mean, all of these things influence us, and they change us. And sometimes when we jettison one, we do go, oh, now I understand what it was bringing to me, and I can live with it and be a part of it, but not have to wholly accept every part of it. And that becomes an important part of individuals with identity, is being able to be in charge of who we are as much as possible, rather than just let everything affect us, is being able to really understand what these things do to us and for us so that we can utilize them in more healthy ways.
So I'm thinking that's a future podcast for us, Kent.
Perfect. Sounds perfect. We go a lot there, let me tell you.
Yeah, it would be interesting in a lot of ways as we explore identity, especially if you are in a conservative institution and trying to Absolutely. Navigate that, or if you've left that and you're trying to find some signposts for navigation, right?
Yes.
From both perspectives. Okay. So, yeah, that'll make a great next podcast when we have our next conversation. So any last thoughts that we didn't get to that you want to share on this topic before we close today?
Yeah, I just think for me, the importance of understanding postmodernism and why, you know, I talked to a lot of people up until the pandemic. My full-time job as a student was a Lyft driver, and I would speak to people all day long as they got in and out of my car. And it was fascinating to talk to so many people. And for me, one of the important things was there's a lot of people who have a lot of questions. And for whatever reason, when people would get into my car, they felt like it was time to open up and we could have these really cool, salient conversations. And I miss that terribly, by the way. being an extrovert holed up in a home during the pandemic is definitely my own personal hell, but that's okay. But being able to work with people and talk to people and see how much people are really wondering what they need, where they are in the world, what their place is in the world, and their concerns and ideals. These ideas of postmodernism and modernism really pervade all people's thoughts and beliefs and ideas. And when we understand them a little bit more, I believe it gives us those tools to, and as I mentioned this just a couple minutes ago, but it gives us the tools to take more control of ourselves. And instead of letting things just happen to us and we react to them, that we can start to take a little bit of control back in our lives and live, in my opinion, live much more healthfully and our well-being being something that is paramount and something that we can be just much more happy and productive members of families and societies and things like that. And I think that although you can get lost in a lot of the weeds in these particular things, I think it's important to understand a lot of these things in order to just take back control of who we are as individuals and be able to be the best versions of ourselves.
Well, it allows us, when we are aware of what's influencing us, it allows us to not just process the awareness, but also process then our intentional behaviors, right? So
Absolutely.
I don't do things out of reaction. I'm not reactionary any longer. I'm intentional in what I'm
Absolutely.
In what I'm doing and saying.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Kent. And thank you for being with us today from Tucson, Arizona. And we appreciate it very much. And we look forward to our next conversation with you here on Project Zion podcast. And so if you are listening today, thank you very much. I'm Karen Peter, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.